Hello, it's Thursday the 27th of August. My name's John Dennis. Today, how a Muslim community leader, whose prayer sessions have been the subject of a campaign by the BNP, was abducted at knife point and had his family threatened by racist thugs.
He came home at about midday, popped home, and his front door was on fire in an apparent firebombing attack.
Also today, as the GCSE results are published, Labour accuses the Tories of trying to create a divide between academic and vocational qualifications.
This country's education system is absolutely plagued by a real snobbery against vocational qualifications.
And Big Brother, which made household names of people like Jade Goody, has been axed by Channel 4.
Now, the one that worried me the most was when you thought that Mother Teresa was related to Mr. Heinstein.
It's because they were being missed at the same time. Well, that's my fault anyway.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, today's headlines with Sue Mansfield.
The UK's most senior financial regulator has said Citibank should be taxed heavily to stop them making excessive profits. Lord Turner, chairman of the Financial Services Authority, described the banks as socially useless and said the bonus culture should be stopped. Writing in the magazine Prospect, Lord Turner said a tax on the millions of transactions that take place every day in the city would be a good revenue source for the government. The UK ambassador in Kabul has defended the use of soldiers to protect Afghan elections despite low voter turnout. Mark Sedwill was responding to reports that just 150 people voted out of 150,000 in a part of Helmand province, where 10 UK troops died fighting the Taliban ahead of the elections. Mr. Sedwill said the test for the success of the elections had to be seen at national rather than a local level, and that irregularities were to be expected across the country. A water shortage described as the most critical since the earliest days of Iraq's civilization is threatening to leave up to 2 million people in the south of the country without electricity and almost as many without drinking water. The supply of electricity to Iraq's fourth largest city of Nasiriyah has fallen by 50% during the last 3 weeks because of the rapidly falling levels of the Euphrates River. Further downriver, the lack of fresh water has raised salinity levels so high that two towns of about 3,000 people on the northern edge of Basra had to be evacuated this week. More than 600,000 students in England, Wales and Northern Ireland will receive their GCSE results later today. It's likely good grades will increase since last year, when more than a fifth of entries were awarded an A or A star. But youth charity The Prince's Trust warned that about half of those taking GCSEs will get a D or lower in English or maths. Last year, more than a third of pupils left school without five A to C grades. The climate camp gets underway on London's Blackheath today after around 1,000 activists set up yesterday. The Metropolitan Police have said they will not be stopping and searching people, but will be photographing everyone who arrives at the camp. The week of workshops and direct action will end on the 2nd of September. And in sport, Arsenal beat Celtic last night by 3-1 at the Emirates to book their place in the Champions League group stages with a 5-1 victory on aggregate. Now let's take a look at today's papers. Four British soldiers die for the sake of 150 votes. That's the headline in the Times, which leads with the story of figures released from last week's Afghan election. Only a handful of the several thousand people in Babaji in Helmand province who were eligible to vote did so. Four of the 10 soldiers who died in the five-week offensive to drive the Taliban out of central Helmand before the election were killed near Babaji. The Daily Mail has pictures of all the 10 soldiers and quotes the mother of one of the soldiers, who says this reflects terribly on our strategy in Afghanistan. The Independent and The Express lead with the news that scientists are on the verge of stopping inherited diseases. The new technique, which has been tested successfully on monkeys, swaps genes between unfertilised eggs before the resulting IVF embryos are implanted into the womb. And The Telegraph chooses instead to look at a survey of NHS patients that claims to show that up to 1 million people have suffered cruelty and squalor while being treated in Britain's hospitals. The study by the Patients Association includes accounts of hundreds of relatives of patients, most of whom died following their care. You can keep up to date on all those stories and breaking news throughout the day at www.guardian.co.uk.
A Muslim community leader was abducted at knife point from his own home. His family have been threatened and his flat has been firebombed. Police in Loughton in Essex believe the hate campaign against Nur Ramjan Ali may be linked to prayer sessions he organises in a local community hall. Vikram Dodd has the story.
Back in March, he started organising a weekly prayer session at a community centre because Muslims in his area didn't have anywhere that close by. The place they'd been going to was too full and also pretty far away. So for a few months this happened, and at the start, 9 people turned up. At times it got up to 80, usually around the 40 to 50 mark. And then in July, he started having some real problems. On July the 2nd, there was a threatening letter received at his home. It was delivered by hand, and it said, "We know which school your son goes to. We know what car you drive. Stop organising these meetings." The next day, he came home at about midday, popped home, and his front door was on fire in an apparent firebombing attack. Late July, the BNP produced a leaflet railing against the meetings he'd been organising, the prayer meetings in a community centre. And then what happened on Monday, and the incident, the latest incident police are investigating, was around about midday. He was abducted from his own home, taken at knife point into a car where he was put in the boot, taken on a drive for about 10 minutes to nearby Epping Forest, where again at knife point he was threatened, told to stop holding those meetings, and that, you know, threats were made to him, which he takes as being death threats, that he should stop, otherwise the worst would happen.
What have the police said about this?
The police have been say they've been investigating this since July, when the first serious incidents happened. They say they're treating all these incidents as hate crimes. They say they're putting substantial resources into the investigation. And they say that they are investigating a possible motive being the controversy, the row over the use of that community hall for those Muslim prayer sessions.
And what have the British National Party said about Mr. Ramjanali's allegations that BNP members were behind the attacks?
Their simple response is, "We deny it. We're not into violence." What the group leader on the local council has said is that, for a start, she said, in pretty much direct quotes, "Firebombing is not something we do. It's not a British method. Brick through the window is more a traditional British method of expressing displeasure." I did talk to the leader of the BNP group on the local council, who's called Pat Richardson. Ultimately, what she's saying is that they think that this weekly prayer group will turn into a bigger group, and then it'll turn into a mosque, and this is some plot or conspiracy to have more Muslims in the area to ultimately vote out the BNP councillors. It's also worth noting that she, after some questioning, conceded that she had seen that BNP leaflet before it went out and did not have any problem with its contents. It talks about an attempt to... there was a threat of the Islamification of the area. This prayer session, it's worth stating, is only two hours a week. There's also Christian sessions at this community centre, and when I went there Wednesday afternoon, if it was a secret mosque, then my God, the conspiracy is huge and massive, because there was a children's play event underway, something called soft play, which I don't think often is unique to the Sunni or Shia sort of strands of Islam.
Vikram, many thanks. And there's more at guardian.co.uk/UK. Also on The Guardian's website today, director Judd Apatow tells Hadley Freeman about his new film Funny People at guardian.co.uk/film. Alexander Chancellor on the deaths of Michael Jackson, Elvis Presley and Edward Kennedy, guardian.co.uk/America. And The Guardian's critics select their cultural highlights of this autumn, including the September issue, that's RJ Cutler's documentary about the Vogue editor Anna Winter, Jonathan Pryce's revival of The Caretaker at the Everyman in Liverpool, the Turner Prize, and the return of Robbie Williams. Guardian.co.uk/arts. In an article in today's Guardian, the Children's Secretary Ed Balls accuses his Conservative shadow Michael Gove of trying to create a two-tier education system. 600,000 pupils find out their GCSE results today, but the economic recession means it's tougher than ever for school leavers to get a job. So, should the government give greater resources to vocational learning? Or have the new vocational diplomas devalued academic qualifications, as the Tories maintain? Polly Curtis is our education editor.
He makes a lot of really quite personal attacks against Michael Gove, the shadow school secretary, claiming that they have switched tack and they're now doing down the state school system and making accusations of dumbing down. He is accusing them of trying to create a two-tiered system again, whereby academic qualifications are valued much higher than vocational qualifications, and relegating children who do vocational qualifications to a kind of second best kind of education. And the mechanism he's attacking is the Tory announcement that they would exclude vocational qualifications from school league tables, saying they want all children to do academic qualifications at least to the age of 16, and that schools wouldn't get any credit for teaching vocational qualifications.
There has been this additional pressure this week on the government to increase the emphasis on vocational qualifications because of the recession. Trade unions and charities have called on the government to put more emphasis on that. I mean, has Ball's got a point?
Certainly. This country's education system is absolutely plagued by a real snobbery against vocational qualifications. We have a very elitist attitude to education. You know, you look at, I put my hands up, you look at the coverage in the papers a lot of the time. We write a lot about Oxford and Cambridge, and we don't write a lot about what the colleges are doing to really train people with the skills that we need in our industries as well. So, I mean, there's an absolute point there that we need to raise the standing of vocational qualifications. The question is whether you do that by introducing one qualification like the government wants to, a diploma that would be a kind of overarching qualification that would take in all kinds of learning, or whether you do what the Tories are saying, which is you prize academic learning, but you create a separate system for vocational learning. They say they still kind of support vocational learning and training, but schools say that if vocational subjects aren't in the league tables, they just won't teach them.
Are GCSEs providing the students with the skills they need?
There's a lot being asked of GCSEs. There's a problem at the top. They're still not distinguishing between the top candidates. There are a lot of students who get all those straight A's. And there's a problem at the other end that they're not catering to students who want the vocational learning. So actually, kind of, there are lots of students who don't do a lot of GCSEs, and they do BTECs and GMVQs and other qualifications, which they get a lot out of. It's the appropriate kind of learning. But this row is really about whether we value those qualifications as much and how you transform the system so that we have a really respected vocational training system in this country that you really, really need. Germany does it really well. They have, their technical schools are as respected, more so than the equivalent of grammar schools. And there's something in the kind of English psyche we need to get past to really recognise that this kind of type of learning is worthwhile and important and, you know, desperately needed.
And this debate that we're seeing, Polly, isn't going to end between now and the next election, is it?
No, what's interesting is that today you're seeing the first GCSE results of children entirely educated under Labour, and Ed Ball's really kicking off a row with Michael Gove over the qualifications either government might use over the next kind of few years. Ed Ball is saying he wants to have a debate scrutinising the Conservative policy on the level that we've seen with the NHS recently. That might be ambitious, but it's important now that we're getting closer and closer to a general election.
Polly Curtis. The climate camp is underway. 7 days of protests by environmental and anti-capitalist activists. Previous camps have been at power stations and at Heathrow Airport. But this year they chose as their location Blackheath in southeast London, which 700 years ago saw the peasants revolt against the poll tax. And it's also the area in which I grew up.
Well, I'm really excited to be at the Camp for Climate Action. Finally, we've been putting a lot of work into planning this.
Well, at the moment we're on Blackheath in southeast London. The climate camp Swoop is converging. The Swoop is where basically everybody arrives at the same time for this climate camp, because one of the main things about climate camp is that it's about everybody mucking in and doing something. It's not a festival that's put on by people. Everybody is the camp, so we've got everyone who's come together. All the equipment's arriving. We've got marquees, we've got toilets, we've got a TV studio, and we're going to set it all up together, and that's part of the camp ethos, is doing it all together.
So there's a whole range of different people coming together, different ages, different occupations, from kind of builders to doctors, students, engineers.
Just taking the site, which is on Blackheath, right in the middle of London. It's being set up. We're expecting anywhere between 1,000 and 3,000 people, I understand. And it's going to be a week of workshops.
Part of the thing about Climate Camp is that as more people arrive and more stuff is needed, the people that arrive will build that stuff. So if 1,000 people decide to come on Saturday morning for the weekend, they have to build their own toilets, or they'll have to get involved in setting up new infrastructure. So it's probably, in a way, it's never finished, but I think the bulk of it will be done by sundown tonight.
The local residents I've spoken to so far have been kind of wonderfully positive. Spoke to a woman and her child who said they wanted to come down. The kid was about 3. She said she wanted to come to climbing camp.
This is cooperation in action, and it proves that these things can be done. You can have such a huge organisation working without leaders, working by consensus, and that's the kind of thing that people tell you is a nice idea that couldn't happen in the real world with a big group of people who don't know each other, who all have different ideas and politics and a lot of strong-willed characters and a few quite wacky ones, and yet we prove it can.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
My name's John Dennis. This is Guardian Daily. Still to come, will Tuesday's violent clashes between Millwall and West Ham football fans affect England's bid to host the World Cup?
All these positive images of Britain can be shattered, you know, in a fateful night in East London where big blokes, some of whom look very much old enough to know better.
But first, Gordon Brown may be sticking to his line of no comment on the decision by the Scottish Justice Secretary Kenny McCaskill to free the Lockerbie bomber. But the UK Justice Secretary Jack Straw took a different approach yesterday during a Guardian seminar on constitutional reform. Columnist Jonathan Friedland, who was chairing the discussion, asked Straw what he would have done.
What I would have done is to look at all the evidence before me and come to a view on that evidence, as I have done I suppose 6.5 years of being responsible for the prison system in England and Wales. What I can't offer you is a view about that decision because I've not seen the evidence, and I simply haven't seen it. And I'm not going to, because I know from long experience that you have to look at the evidence. This is a decision for the Scottish Executive.
Do you think, though, in gathering that evidence, the Scottish Justice Secretary made the right move in going to visit the prisoner in jail? Would you have done that if you'd been in his...
Well, that was his decision. I mean, if you're asking me whether have I ever visited a prisoner in jail who's applied for compassionate release, the answer to that is no. And what I had said, and this has been on the public record, what I said in answer to questions from the Joint Committee on Human Rights... which was raising issues. It's actually about the prisoner transfer agreement, which in the end wasn't used, but raising issues about, since this was a PTA where the consent of the prisoner was not directly required, what rights would the prisoner have? Well, I said in a letter to, I think, to Alex Salmon, that the prisoner would have a right to make written representations, which for sure is true. But it's for Scots to decide their own processes, and their legal system has been different forever. I mean, it's not just been different since 1999. It's been different. So it was part of the Act of Settlement, the Act of Union in 1707. But I've not gone on visits to individual prisoners.
And you were about to say, would you have done it? And what would be the answer?
I was saying you would not
have gone to see him.
Well, I can't say I would not have gone, because I'm just saying I haven't seen all the circumstances. Have I ever gone to see a prisoner in those a prisoner who's applied for compassionate release? No, I've relied on written representations. But there we are.
Is it quite convenient for the UK government that this decision was taken by the Scottish government and the SNP administration?
Yeah, I don't think it's an issue of convenience or otherwise, Jonathan. If it hadn't been taken by the Scottish Executive, it would have fallen to the Scottish Secretary of State. But it's not an issue of convenience. It has always been the case that Scotland's had a separate jurisdiction. I mean, I may say for the lawyers present, I mean those of us who are lawyers know that it's a very separate jurisdiction. And this was just a natural consequence of that separate jurisdiction.
And you don't have an opinion whether it was right or wrong?
I can't have an opinion on whether it was right or wrong. I've not seen the evidence. And I don't think even The Guardian would be asking me to shoot from the hip on that issue without seeing the detailed evidence. And also, I'm not in that position. And I just say that my last point here is that there is, even if you have seen the evidence, there is a world of difference between having to come to a decision, which is a binary choice, and it's, you know, do you let these individuals out or don't you? And making observations from the sidelines.
And when you say evidence, you mean about how ill he was?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Look, no, sort of evidence I had to consider, for example, in respect of Mr. Biggs.
Jack Straw talking at The Guardian yesterday. A disgrace to football was how the sports minister Jerry Sutcliffe described Tuesday's violence between West Ham and Millwall fans. One 44-year-old man was stabbed in the chest during the clashes, which happened outside and inside the ground in East London. The clashes brought back memories of the bad old days of football hooliganism of the 1970s and 80s. I asked The Guardian's David Conn what the root causes were of the fierce antagonism between West Ham and Millwall supporters.
Well, I mean, at the root of this is the deep social roots of, it's not just blokes fighting at football, it's British blokes fighting, and football was always, and the Home Office, I've been having some good conversations with the Home Office, including to a senior source who's involved in not policing football, but in trying to develop the strategy to deal with football violence. And they actually accept, quite surprisingly, that there has always been violence at football right from the beginnings of professional football in the 1880s. It's not just something that happened in the 60s, 70s and 80s, although it became more organised and more intense, and it became sort of rival firms wanting to defend their territory rather than people kind of scrapping, randomly, spontaneously scrapping. So there are these roots there of organised football hooliganism, which has taken a long time to decline. I think, having spent a long time thinking about it and writing about it since it happened on Tuesday night, that it was actually exaggerated in the 70s and 80s. It was a horrible atmosphere at too many games. It did happen at too many games, but there was also a hell of a lot of posturing, chanting, and a general atmosphere, a hostile atmosphere. But the numbers of actual incidents of fighting, I think that people do accept that it was always a minority, even if it was a larger minority, and there was a lot of people around them who gloried in it. And what we have now is, if you like, a much dramatically declining number of incidents, but nevertheless we've got that legacy. We still have a culture where there's drinking and fighting, and the way it's been described to me from the Home Office is that there's always a risk there, and that risk doesn't come much higher than a West Ham Millwall cup tie.
What are the possible consequences of this for the clubs and for England's bid to stage the 2018 World Cup?
It's clear that the FA believes that it could have an impact on the bid to host the World Cup, because the FA and the 2018 bid team itself, which is operated separately, issued statements straight away which condemned the violence in the strongest possible terms, but also pointed out that, fairly I think, but were at pains to point out that violence has declined over the last 20 years. So that shows that they obviously see it as a threat to a bid which has been built on the great stadia we have, the flourishing football culture, the fact that Britain is a multi-ethnic metropolitan society. All these positive images of Britain can be shattered, you know, in a fateful night in East London where big blokes, some of whom look very much old enough to know better, start, you know, rampaging around and causing mayhem.
David Conn. One of the defining programmes on UK television in the noughties, Big Brother, has been axed by Channel 4. Its three-year deal with producer Endemol means an 11th and final series will be screened next year. But the number of people watching it has fallen from 8 million between 2002 and 2006 to just 2 million. And it's no longer making profits of £68 million as it did at its peak. There have been moments of real drama in Big Brother, such as this clip from the first series when the housemates discovered Nasty Nick's plotting behind their backs.
Dear 35, as soon as everyone's up, the meeting is called.
Okay, well, I've got a very important thing I want to bring up. I think everyone should be aware of it, and it's everybody's concern. Sorry I have to say it, Nick, but I'm very disappointed in yourself. I not only feel, I'm quite positive and got evidence that you're plotting a very dirty plan on everybody in here to vote against each other and steer it divert from you.
I asked The Guardian's Maggie Brown, author of A Licence to be Different, the story of Channel 4, At what point it started to go wrong for Big Brother?
Well, I think it did incredibly well up until about 2005. It also had a huge afterlife on, life on the web. I mean, it was one of the, probably the programme that revolutionised webcasting, the ability to watch something live. In fact, it's said that there was a complete breakdown at the Nasty Nick moment because people could watch it on their computers in the office. But A, the world caught up with them. Secondly, I think that the coup de grace, in a way, was delivered by actually the celebrity Big Brother version in the January of 2007, which came to be known as a sort of this very nasty racist programme when there was this kind of stand-up confrontation between Shilpa Shetty and Jade Goody and her family. I don't think it ever really recovered its bounce after that.
Julian Bellamy, the head of Channel 4, has said that Big Brother will leave a huge hole in its schedules. How will Channel 4 fill that?
Well, he's right. I mean, one of the other factors that you could say contributing to people's boredom with Big Brother is that they expanded it too much. So it was taking up over 125, spread over 125 days when you added in the celebrity Big Brother and the summer Big Brother. So as event television, it became much too long an event, if you like, and bored people. The other side of it is that they have a lot of programming slots. E4 in particular very much flourished on the back of Big Brother initially. So both E4 and Channel 4 do have very big challenges. On the other hand, Big Brother is costing Channel 4 at the moment at least £60 million a year. So despite the fact advertising revenue is falling anyway, it frees up an estimated £50 million a year by 2011 to invest in new programming.
And might another television channel show Big Brother?
I think it's highly possible because even now it's still profitable for Channel 4. When it was last being renegotiated, Channel 4 had to bid against All We Think. And ITV never actually put in a bid, but ITV were interested. There are a range of digital channels, maybe even Channel 5, who might be interested. I haven't heard of anything yet because this is very early days, even though, as I say, for people in the know, this decision doesn't really come as a surprise.
Maggie Brown. Phil Maynard and Harriet Grant produced Guardian Daily today. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.